was very famous as a counter-jihadist, and he had to leave his native Pakistan to take his family with him because of persecution. She is the editor of Muslim World Today, a progressive newspaper, which happens to be pro-Israel, and she is affiliated with Islam Watch, I forget the exact title. Sapna makes a distinction between being a Muslim and being an Islamist, which is a political position. And she has a very interesting story to tell about her life and her particular way of being a Muslim and being a counter-jihad. So please help me welcome Sapna Zaidi.
Thank you for having me today. I know that no one knows me, and
this
might not be the most attractive to people in the audience today, but I welcome your questions and disagreeing positions, including Mr. Officers, later on today. How do I start? I'll tell you a little bit about myself and my family, so maybe then my opinions after will make a little more sense and be put into some context. I was born in Pakistan. My dad was a journalist and a part of the People's Party, which is a socialist leading party. It was Benazir Bhutto's family party. Her father, who was hanged in the late 70s for his liberal positions, was hanged because 60s, 70s, the Cold War was getting stronger. In Afghanistan, the Russians were there. The Americans were in Pakistan trying to have that covert war for opinion in Pakistan between the communist-leaning groups with the non-communist groups. But the problem in Pakistan was that there was no democratic movement. You had a country that was, after the British left South Asia, kind of marred with ethnic conflict, where I think the Muslim population from South Asia were... Some of them were afraid that they would be discriminated against because they were, prior to the British, part of the Mughal Muslim ruling imperial group that brought India together. So you had certain people that, like Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who founded Pakistan, want a separate place where Muslims could be equal. The problem Pakistan has had ever since its founding is that the question that's never been answered is, just because we're a majority Muslim, are we an Islamic country or are we a secular country? Meaning, like, was the separation just for the sake of having your own faith to build a future, or was it to be specifically Sharia mandated, whatever that meant to them at that time? The question has never been resolved, and up until today, Pakistan's had an identity crisis where, because they've never been able to truly articulate an identity for themselves, they've always been challenged by kind of a bipolar personality. Culturally, Pakistanis are completely Indian. Majority of Pakistanis historically are probably converts from Hinduism or some other non-Muslim community to Islam, or they are, like my family, where we trace our family tree back to actually the Middle East and believe we are direct descendants of the Prophet. The title is Sayyid, and it goes into a lot of Muslim names that believe that to be a big deal. 2009, I don't really think it matters, but it's still in our names. So, having said that, Pakistan now has faced, since the Cold War, an influence from what we call Wahhabi Salafi money coming from Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries to encourage that Islamic identity over a secular national identity, versus what I would say my father and grandfather's generation that really saw themselves as Indian, and where the languages, the culture, the clothing, the mannerisms were really fairly identical to whatever region or part of India one was from. My parents on both sides are from northern India, where we still have relatives on that side of the border, and we have plenty of relatives in Pakistan too, and it's very easy to see the psychological trajectory and how that's made people different when I see my relatives, whether they're in Pakistan versus India. My Indian relatives in Delhi are very secular. There are some of them are Orthodox, but still see Islam as a private faith where they pray, fast, do whatever they do, and have cousins that have married Hindus. No one cares. because they see themselves as Indian first, and most importantly, they see religion as a private faith and a private action. You go to Pakistan, on the other hand, where you have a country marred from its inception by an identity crisis internally and externally, an inferiority complex. India is way bigger. India has a lot more resources. Yet they have this problem with Kashmir. Kashmir is majority Muslim, so why wasn't it a part of Pakistan? Why does India want Kashmir rather than let it be a part of Pakistan? So where one would have hoped that Pakistan in the 40s and 50s would have spent its money on education, infrastructure, schools, it spends over 60% of its budget on military. That has left a nice void consistently since the 50s of no education in Pakistan. You have over 60% of the population that are illiterate. Where what they consider literacy to be is, if I can put, I think, an X for signature, when they're doing their votes and polling and stuff like that, that's their generic literacy. My sister-in-law used to work for an NGO for 9 years in Pakistan, so she's educated me a lot on efforts to better women, for example, and other rural community members through microfinance and things like that. So by explaining that foundation, I just want to try to explain what that psychological and social environment is that has allowed for those madrasas that are in the thousands in Pakistan to be a home for children that otherwise are blank slate when they walk in, you know, 5 years old, 8 years old, whatever. So what are they going to learn? When they are told in their homes, you're a Muslim, you're supposed to be a good Muslim kid, you should worry about heaven and hell and, you know, bettering your society, and you should worry about what God will think of you when you die. Which goes to Mr. Oster's question, what is Sharia and why should we defend any fraction of it, if at all? Which I completely respect and understand. But where I differ is I don't see Sharia as a monolithic thing. Very, like, broadly. You know, it's defined as Islamic law, literally in Arabic, you know, like to the watering path or something like that. Since Islam's inception, well, first problem is when the Prophet was alive and by the time he passed away, he articulated no codes or laws in a way that could kind of like run on its own once he died. So after he passed away, he right away had a battle for leadership. Who wants to be in charge? And it became a nice big fight. What Islamists call before the golden age that they want to go back to, is they don't talk about a golden age in the sense of some kind of religious superiority or an understanding of the faith in an ethical or practical way that all Muslims were better people then. They're talking about a period of time when Muslims were militarily and politically superior. And of course today it sucks because we're not militarily and politically superior. So therefore, Muslim life today, Muslim society today, is weaker and inferior. So how do we get back to the golden age when we were on top? Completely ignoring the historical trajectory of Muslim society from Turkey to Africa to South Asia, or now Indonesia, Malaysia, and the diversity of Islamic communities and the way they practice their faith, Islamists think that there is one way to be Muslim. There is the Quran and Hadith, which is the way of the Prophet. If you go back to this book and these treatises, you will somehow magically find an answer for economics, sociology. You'll find an answer from all kinds of modern problems that didn't even necessarily exist back then. Which I think is false, absolutely false, because from a variety, even if you read the Quran and you read the Hadith, they don't make sense like that. You can't take a verse and by itself see something so objectively universal that everyone can jump on it. And this is why I differentiate between what a Muslim is and what an Islamist is. Islamists are individuals who believe that the faith is a complete foundation for a modern socio-political society. Like communism, like capitalism, it is an alternative to the latter two. Muslims, on the other hand, and the way I'm defining it, absolutely, I know that this is a much debated topic, but Muslims are the majority of men, women, and children living in the Islamic world that over time have adapted local customs just as much as Arab customs as Islam spread through the region that do not, how do I say it? Islam is a primary identity marker in these parts of the world because it is a post-imperial culture. You had, up until World War I, the Ottoman Empire was lasted about 800 years. Before that, had various Islamic empires that competed with each other and fought. But when the First World War ended, you really had enough, that was the paradigm that was left. It was a subject mentality, that was a we mentality, a group mentality, that was based on religion. What happened after World War I, when you had the British and the French come with different treaties and different engagement with Arab leaders and things and create the mandate states and put, encourage secular constitutions and legal codes in. What happened was because the populations have no concept of individualism and citizenship, and you know, like the way we say, you know, no taxation without representation, these aren't concepts that they grew up with. They were more readily have an affinity towards the dictator, towards the autocrat, someone like a child to a parent. You will expect them to do for you, but you don't know how to fight back when they are not doing what even you perceive as wrong. And in the religious context, which is where I differ from individuals that see Islam and Sharia as a monolithic thing, is Sharia, since, you know, centuries back, has varied from region to region. And it has been implemented 100% or partially from region to region, depending on who was in power in that place in that time. For that reason, when you have things like FGM, female genital mutilation, it is pre-Islamic practice that exists in African Arab countries. The problem is, though, when Islam absorbed these territories, it didn't solve the problem. Instead, even as people converted to Islam, they now justified FGM in Islamic language, with Islamic quotes, with Islamic understandings of male and female roles. This is why if you go to Pakistan, India, Indonesia, you will not find FGM. It is not practiced there. If you mention, like, it just doesn't happen. But the same thing with, like, honor killings and other issues that have to do with social relations. A lot of these practices were already part of the cultures where Islam spread, but Islam did not solve the problem. It did not eradicate the problem. Instead, it reinforced the cultural behaviors by imams in a patriarchal culture that justified it not only in tribal cultural norms, but now in religious rhetoric. And when you slap religion on top of it, you get that sense of, you know, godliness, and then you really can't fight back because there's such deference to one's fear and faith of God and the clerics that are interpreting that faith for them. So what's my point? Sharia. When I define it, I try to separate it as two different things. There's what I would call personal Sharia, which is the tenets of Islam that talk about praying five times a day, fasting, charity, dietary habits. There's nothing wrong with these aspects of practicing one faith because you see it across the board in other faiths and philosophies. So long as it is personal, so long as it's not enforced upon a person, so far as that person themselves does not demanded of others or expect the taxpayers to pay for it, it's fine. Do what you have to do. But then recognize, at least in Western society, where we have secular laws and traditions, that in practicing and in protecting people's faith, there is a standard that we hold to defend and keep all faith equal that naturally will limit one's right to express a belief or a spirituality that they have if it encroaches on the person next to them or in any way conflicts with the laws of the land. So in this sense, I would say when a Muslim says, like the Somali cab drivers in Minneapolis a couple of years ago, like Daniel Pipes wrote about these cab drivers that didn't want to pick up people carrying alcohol. Okay. Okay.
This should not be your profession.
Well, I mean, more than that, though, it's actually even more than that. In Eastern culture, because, again, you have that we mentality, we're taught that, okay, drinking is a sin. I shouldn't drink. Fine. So in my house, you're not going to find liquor, right? But then it goes another step. I should not be encouraging people to drink. That's what we're taught, right? So that means I shouldn't own a liquor store, because even if I'm not drinking, I shouldn't be selling it. So now if I'm a cab driver, if you are taught this kind of mentality from wherever you come from, the idea is, well, if I give somebody a ride in my cab and they're carrying alcohol, somehow I'm tacitly consenting to their drinking, which is a sin, and I shouldn't do that. Well, that's okay in Pakistan, maybe. But in the United States, where we have expectations of individual responsibility, and we don't believe in imposing religious beliefs on other people, you cannot do that. If I think it's a sin to drink, I won't drink, but I don't care if my friend is on their seventh beer at dinner with me. It doesn't matter. But what these Somali cab drivers did, which was their mistake, unfortunately, but I believe they had no recourse, which isn't excusing them, is some Somali cab driver probably went to their mosque and went to their imam and said, hey, you know, I have people that come in my cab and they're carrying alcohol. Should I give them a ride? This imam said, no, you shouldn't give them a ride, and went and said, there's this in the Quran, there's that in the Quran, or hadith, whatever he pointed to, and justified that behavior. That is where we have a problem. It is about assimilating and integrating immigrants into American culture in a way that they feel they are respected for who they are, but at the same time are not excused in any way, shape, or form for bending laws, which in their sense is a complete misunderstanding of American laws and sensibilities, and excusing it as, oh, I'm an immigrant, it's the wrong understanding of multiculturalism and pluralism, because they forget that a person doesn't believe what you believe. Even if the people they're picking up are Muslims, you don't have a right to tell someone to pray or fast or do anything else that is no business of yours. So this is a question of accountability within the Muslim community, of imams, clerics, Islamic schools, and how they are teaching Muslim children and immigrants about personal responsibility of faith versus groupthink. Groupthink is unacceptable if in any way it questions or conflicts with the laws of the given city, county, or state. So I would say the problem lies, and this is why I say, you know, there's a difference between Muslims and Islamists, and why I say there's a difference even between moderate Muslims and American Muslims, it's kind of a demarcation of different levels of belief. If for me, a Muslim is somebody who, like any other American or Westerner, kind of figures out how their religion works for them, given the tenets of their faith in the society to live in, an Islamist is the one that doesn't want to accept any part of Western laws if they think it conflicts with the faith. So it's being Muslim first rather than being American first or British or French first. That is the politicized version of Islam that now in Pakistan has political parties behind it. There's the Jamaat Islami, which actually never had any votes in the 60s, but now have more influence. You see in the news the Northwest Frontier Province, where the Taliban groups over there have now are imposing Sharia. It's a complete appeasement by the central government, not because they want it, but because they can't fight it. It's a tacit consent that we do not have the resources and the manpower to fight this. President Obama, though I'm still keeping my fingers crossed, I don't know how this first year should go, I'm very disheartened by his policies to engage Islamists, because he is now legitimizing Islam as a politicized movement. He is not defending it as a private faith. He's completely shooting in the foot secular Muslims like my dad or other people that have to leave Muslim societies to not be told what to do or how to live. But he's basically saying, oh, this movement is completely legit, and so long as they're not violent, we'll work with them. Well, okay, so the villager shaves the beard, puts down the gun, puts on the night suit, comes into his meeting with, you know, his fellow citizens of Pakistan or Afghanistan, or comes here to Washington, D.C. to have whatever diplomatic meeting. What is the purpose of their meeting? How much can you negotiate with somebody that at the end of the day does not believe in a quality of faith, but believes in their faith having a say over your faith or no faith at all? That's the question. And what's worse is when you engage Islamists abroad, you completely forget that in a modern society with economics, telecommunications, work, everything going back and forth, you cannot isolate a community. You cannot isolate ideas or resources. So when you empower Islamists as a legitimate group by meeting with them and shaking their hand on television, you're further allowing all their money and all their curriculum and all their leaders to come over here, and they have the money to start Islamic institutions. They have the power to start, you know, what they call civil rights organizations like CARE, which to me is Arab lobbying. There's a huge difference. I'm Muslim. I'm Pakistani. CARE, in my personal opinion, you can't sue me for defamation, it's just my opinion. They're not a Muslim rights organization. They're an Arab lobbying group. And if you want to be an Arab lobbying group and say you're anti-Israeli, you're anti-Israeli, good for you. But don't say that you're Muslim. You know what I mean? There's a complete difference. The majority of Muslims in the world are not Arab. Less than 18% of the Muslim population with all the oil money, which is a whole kind of conversation we can have about this government getting mad for Americans for 9/11, but continuing to engage in oil politics and Bush hugging and kissing that Saudi prince that one year in Texas. When those Saudis are the ones that are ruining the country I left, and are now engaging in politics in the United States that is marginalizing any secular or liberal Muslim here. As my dad used to say, there's not many places to go. So the U.S. is going to actually start going in a direction where their version of Islam is the only version of Islam left. Where someone like me that wants to be proud to be American, believe what I believe, fast, pray, that I'm not orthodox enough for the Sunnis from Saudi Arabia. I don't want to wear a niqab. I don't believe that's part of my faith. Or I want to engage in my faith in a way that is personal to me. So the problem is to say that a faith or a group should be completely disengaged with because you don't believe in certain premises from where they're coming from, or even the origins of their faith, is to ignore the fact you cannot kill and you cannot isolate. With the best of immigration laws, you cannot isolate. So what can we do? And believe me, I'm not an apologist by any means. I get very angry, especially when I think of my dad and all the stuff he went through in Pakistan and here. What we can do is, instead of being reactive and getting angry about this or that specifically, is be proactive. The best thing I learned in law school, or the best class I had rather, was constitutional law. And the nice thing was, I know that Mr. Oster and other people in our position, regardless of the details, are well aware of the fact that the law is on our side. Laws are well established through the Constitution, its various interpretations over the decades, that we have separation of church and state. We have diversity, and I say this as a liberal, that diversity doesn't really mean anything if you don't have standards. It's not a free-for-all. That's not what pluralism means. But to have equality and to have a shared respect for different cultures and faiths, there's a line always. And when you start encroaching and not saying stop to that group, saying, hey, I'm not being anti-whatever by telling you to stop doing whatever it is you're requesting. I'm asking you to respect the other faiths in the room, so to speak. I'm asking you to respect the laws of this land, respect the atheists just as much as they respect the most orthodox Jew or Christian. So when we have specific examples of hookah or halal kitchens out in public schools, or we have issues of dress like the hijab versus the niqab, it doesn't have to be a question about being anti-Islam or anti-Muslim. It has to be a question about what are our standards here, very neutrally. Like when we talk about textbooks, and we have the problem of the Islamist organizations and their influence on the Islam chapters in 7th grade textbooks in the United States. I don't care if they have the most vile stuff to say or the most whitewashed Pollyanna interpretations of the most militant century in Islam. What I care about is, in American public schools, we have a standard for education. What is that standard? It's neutral, unbiased information based on facts, which is based on historical understanding, archaeology, not faith-based interpretations. So given that standard, how does X paragraph in whatever book not meet that standard? So I can have a sentence that says, Jesus was the Son of God. That everyone would argue because it's an open question whether he's the Son of God. So then the correction becomes, Christians believe Jesus is the Son of God. Now we're all okay with the sentence. Fine. It can be about Buddhism. It can be about some aspect of science. And it has to be about Islam as well. We can have the debate about here's Islam, here's the five pillars, here's blah, blah, blah about demographics. But we can't ignore the fact that, hey, guess what? Ever since the 1900s or the imperial age of Islam in the 7th century, certain words have been used in multiple ways. Today to say jihad is only internal struggle is a fallacy. In Shiite Islam specifically, you're taught there are five levels of jihad. One is internal struggle, but it does kind of rise up to the level of, I will kick your ass. For whatever reason. Sorry, I should have asked. But there are five levels of jihad. There is the internal struggle, which is about being a better person, which is what I think progressive secular movements would like to focus on today, which would like to focus on the spiritual internal improvement of individuals. Then there is the aspects of jihad which look at Muslims as part of a community and how do we defend our faith on a community level. You can have jihad through the pen, which is writing, the debate, the intellectual struggle. You can have jihad through resources, which is, in the most negative way, there's fundraising. For example, if you believe in a certain cause, you should use your resources if you're unable to fight to then provide resources for those who are fighting. I'm forgetting one, but then there is the actual military, which is the highest level of jihad. These are legitimate interpretations of an aspect of Islam. That's fine. I have, you know, in a weird way, to be fair, when I look at imperial Islam and when people make arguments about this is what Islam is and this is what it did for those centuries, I do make a distinction between the modern age, which is like the nation state age in history, like post-World War I, and imperial history preceding it. When you had Muslim and Arabic empires, which morphed into Persian empires and Turkish empires and North African or in India, the Mughal Empire, these were populations that were Muslim that expanded as they did through military, political force. Conversions were forced and by choice. It probably varied and whatever. But that was a part of imperial history and dynamics. We can talk about, to whatever degree of likeness, similarity, dissimilarity, about the Pope, the Inquisition, whatever happened in Latin America, killing Native Americans. But the point is, like Mr. Oster said, in certain contexts, it's history. And in certain contexts, like Islam, it's still relevant today, apparently, when we look at what's going on in the Muslim world. That is the distinction we need to make today. So this is why I think people like Daniel Fives in my work were trying to make that distinction between Islamism and Islam, because we want to encourage a psychological divide, not only among non-Muslims who are concerned about these issues, but Muslims themselves. If I talk about personal Sharia versus the types of Sharia that don't work in secular society, I'm giving Muslims a choice. But psychologically, you don't have to abandon who you are and where you come from, but there's a way to be Muslim that fits the 21st century, and there's a way to be Muslim that does not. It is your choice to choose which path you choose to follow and which you do not. So in that sense, I, again, agree with Mr. Oster. If you're going to have imams and curriculum and textbooks that focus on any version of jihad or any version of encouraging anti-Semitism, racism, misogyny, whatever, it's unacceptable. There are ways to interpret the Quran and Hadith in a way that changes and encourages the Muslim community to grow and be progressive, or there is that archaic, backwards interpretation, the literalist interpretation of Islam, to keep it in the Stone Age. My last point, and then we can start talking, is even within the Islamist groups and organizations that are very good at lobbying and have a lot of relationships with liberal politicians and now the Obama administration, I would just leave you with one real concern that I do have, and I hope that maybe even the public out of this room, we could have this conversation in different venues, is I'm very concerned about the definition of moderation being about nonviolence. Because again, as discussed already, violence is just a strategy. It is a way, it's a symptom of an ideology or disease, depending on where you are on the problem. Rather than dealing with the problem itself. There is what I see in my research being a growing likelihood that violence might not even be an issue 10 years from now. But Islamism will still be, because what they're increasingly doing in their writings is saying, we do not want to overthrow American society for jihad. But in understanding American rhetoric, we like it by persuasion. That becomes the issue of conversion, proselytizing, encouraging Muslims to think of the identity marker being Muslim first rather than American first. And when I go to vote, I'm going to think of Palestine and other causes first as a Muslim, and which candidate is for my local lobbying effort. So the idea of a global caliphate, it's one thing that they want to invade and, you know, like in Swath and Pakistan or other parts of the Middle East, that they want to spread Sharia abroad in those regions. They know they can't do that in the West. They know they can't do it in North America. But what they can do is create a lobbying force through demographics, through voting bloc, to encouraging Muslims to politicize themselves in a way where they can directly affect foreign policy in the short term and all kinds of Muslims issues, what they perceive as Muslim issues in the long term. This hurts Muslims first because it pigeonholes us into, number one, increasingly being viewed as the fifth column, which I very much increasingly be viewed as a fifth column, because then it always puts us into question. If I'm going to read books and go to mosques, or, you know, have my nephew go to school where they're constantly being encouraged to see themselves as a group first and then see everybody as against them, then sure, they're going to have that chip on their shoulder, which wasn't even there before. So I have a nephew who's 1 year old. He's growing up in New Jersey. His dad's a doctor. They're not rich yet. My brother's paying off his loans. But, you know, he's going to grow up middle class, at least. He has no reason to think of himself as a marginalized individual by the time he's 20. But when he grows up, and he will grow up Muslim, if he grows up into a community that is completely outflanked by politicized Muslims, I worry about what kind of views he's going to have about being an American, about how he's going to feel about, you know, constitutional rights and how he feels about people of other faiths. I hope that it's not possible for him to go in a direction that I don't like, because my whole family's like us, and there's no way. But what about the kids he goes to school with? If he goes to college and he wants to go to Muslim Student Association because it's Ramadan and it's fasting and he'd like to be around other kids for breaking their fast at, you know, 6 o'clock or whatever the time it is, I worry about what kind of kid he's going to be. So he has no community then. So for me, it's not a choice about, I don't have the choice. I don't have the luxury to say it. It's the drawing. Because I'm part of the community. So I have to think about what it can be versus how certain people are continuing to push it to be. And I encourage people to think about what it means to be American rather than to worry about what the bad things are, and redefine your position about what your own standards are. Not about just textbooks, but about citizenship, about separation of church and state, about issues of when we say no foot baths or halal kitchens, we're not talking about foot baths or halal kitchens. We're talking about taxpayer money and the separation of church and state. And if you want a foot bath, that's fine, pay for it yourself. If a Jewish community wants kosher food in the cafeterias, that's great, you're expected to pay for it yourself. Those are the issues. And why do we do that? We don't say we're anti-Jewish or anti-Muslim, because we're saying if you have certain needs, figure it out, a way will help you implement it. But it's to keep all faith equal. Public schools don't have the luxury to spend millions of dollars to give one group something and then everybody everything that they request. We don't have the means. And so, just, I'll end with, there's a positive way to fight these things, and then there's a negative way to fight these things that encourages anger versus a positive push that is actually more inclusive in the long run.